Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. My name is Dr. Dave O'Brien from Goldsmiths, the University of London. On this episode, I'm talking to Helena Gelfinkel, who is Associate Professor of English at Southern Illinois University. We'll be talking about her new book, Outlaw Fathers in Victorian and Modern British Literature, Queering Patriarchy, which was published in 2014 by Farley Dickinson University Press. So welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm going to be talking to Helena Gelfinkel, who is Associate Professor of English at Southern Illinois University. And we're going to be discussing her new book, which was published in 2014 by Farley Dickinson University Press, which is called Outlaw Fathers in Victorian and Modern British Literature. So welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on.
Thank you very much.
So I guess to kick off with it, it'd be really interesting to hear a bit about your academic background, your interests, and something about the development of the book and where the book has kind of come from.
Well, I teach Victorian literature and critical theory at my university, and this is almost precisely my background. This book, the genesis of this book, is in my doctoral dissertation at Tufts University, so this is a heavily revised dissertation. And I first became interested in queer theory, in psychoanalytic theory, primarily in Lee Edelman's courses at Tufts University. So I was lucky to be able to study with this great mind, a leading figure, really, in queer studies. And the first class I took with him was on psychoanalytic approaches to literature, and subsequently on queer theory. And I started becoming interested in Freud, and I read first Freud, The Father and the Negative Oedipus Complex. I read Leonardo da Vinci and the Memory of His Childhood, and read The Wolfman, read The Child is Being Beaten, and then started reading around Freud, people like Leo Bersani and Daniel Bjarin and Kaja Silverman, and that was the genesis of the book. So I decided to work on fathers or queer fathers in literature, particularly focusing on this negative Oedipus narrative. And subsequently, I expanded and developed the dissertation. So Henry James is definitely a new addition. Patricia Powell is a new addition. Some of my media and pop culture discussions are definitely a new addition. So that's how it started, and that's where it got eventually.
I suppose a good place to start with the book is the kind of the key terms. So outlaw father, or this idea of a queer patriarch, what do you sort of mean by those? And I guess could you do a bit of scene setting by explaining those terms?
Sure. Outlaw father is a pun, a somewhat heavy-handed Lacanian pun, although this is not a heavily Lacanian book. I use the signification of the phallus in the conclusion, but not before that. So Lacan's Law of the Father, this is the Outlaw Father, and queer patriarchy it's a set of relationships, I would say. First, this is the sort of relationship between the father and the son that fits a negative Oedipal paradigm. So, and that anticipates a bit your question about the role of Freud to this discussion, which, you know, really is fundamental. So straight patriarchy then follows the positive Oedipal narrative, where the relationship between the father and the son are based on competition, the fear of castration, whereas the negative Oedipal paradigm is the paradigm of love and submission, if you will. And also the son in the negative paradigm assumes a sort of a feminized position and has a certain kind of stereotypical feminine characteristics. So love and submission in terms of the relationship between father and sons, the kind of masculinity that assumes stereotypically feminized positions, and also fathers and sons as not necessarily biological entities, I would say. Father figures are figures who are in some ways emotionally, financially, artistically influential, but not necessarily biological fathers, although I have those as well.
Do you have a particular definition of fatherhood in the text? One thing that comes up really interestingly in the conclusions of the book is the inclusion of female to male trans people and some of their experiences.
Fatherhood, as I just said, fatherhood need not be biological. So we have, you know, relationships like biological fathers, patrons, artistic role models, or just influential older men. In terms of the trans experience, I would say that I was particularly fascinated by the idea, and here in Patricia Powell's The Pagoda, that the same person, the same being, can be simultaneously a father and a mother, which is precisely how it works out. And so I think that the kind of gender binaries that we're observing completely go out the window by the time we get to code into trans fathers' experiences. So there are multiple definitions of fatherhood, but I'm moving away from biology as much as I can.
That move away from biology to broaden out your definition of fatherhood, I think, is part of your project of kind of queering patriarchy more broadly and more generally. And you talk about four reasons for this, some of which you've touched on around the identification between power and masculinity and the way that we might need to locate non-heterosexual relationships outside of patriarchy and how we might resist that and this range of unequal relationships between older and younger men. I wonder if you could tell me a bit about the kind of the purpose underpinning the act of queering patriarchy that the book attempts to do.
I think that, well, patriarchy is sort of the word, for one thing, that's the word that we throw around oftentimes without thinking what it really means and stopping to give it a consideration. And, you know, if you think about it, we're in the midst of a very fundamental redefinition of male roles. And particularly, I think, you know, we have two things going on. Manhood and the status of a provider are not necessarily linked as inextricably as they used to be, particularly in today's economic conditions. And secondly, the definition of family has been changing and will be changing, I think, for a while. And so against the backdrop of these societal changes, we need to think about what patriarchy means given these changing conditions. In other words, we cannot say patriarchy in 2015 or, you know, 2014 when the book came out and still think of it in terms of the 1960s or 70s. That, I think, is simply inaccurate. So that kind of a societal change was really fundamentally behind my attempt to queer patriarchy, to think why this discussion of queer fatherhood is relevant now. And, of course, I don't pretend, you know, to come up with a women-friendly patriarchy. Quite frankly, I don't think it's possible. But to think that some of the subjectivities that patriarchy supposedly opposes, like queer or, you know, female-identified or trans subjectivities, that it actually already includes, that is the move that I wanted to make. That's an idea that I wanted people to consider.
It's interesting you mention the problematic positions assigned to women within these queer patriarchal ideas. And I think you draw quite an interesting distinction between the idea of excluding women from, say, the relationships or spaces of men rather than directly oppressing them as a kind of a still problematic but different relationship to women generated by queer patriarchy.
Yes, these are not well, I have two novels by women, by queer women, that I discuss at the end, but none of the texts that come before the conclusion are really, none of them are women-friendly texts. You know, none of them are women-inclusive texts. None of them are gender equality-oriented texts. So there is not much I can say in defense of, say, Anthony Trollope and women, or even Alan Hollinghurst and women. And I think that, you know, that when it comes to Hollinghurst, he personally got the brunt of that critique as well. So, And I was being very careful, I think, in delineating my moral goals because I work in masculinity studies. And even though there's a great debt owed to feminist theory, this is not a book about women or about female authors. So it's a bit problematic and remains that way, I suppose.
The other, you touched on this in the introduction, the other major... I guess, female unfriendly or problematic thing running through the text is the use of Freud. And I found this kind of fascinating deployment of Freud's theories because you're very willing to engage with extensive kind of criticism of his work. And I just wonder if you could, thinking about what you mentioned at the start, maybe set the scene a little in terms of the role of Freud in the book. For example, maybe say a little bit more about this negative Oedipus complex idea, or perhaps why the case of the Wolfman is so important to the book.
While I'm willing to concede that most of the texts, most of the literary texts in my book are not, inclusive of women or not women-friendly, I wouldn't necessarily say the same about Freud because I think, he considers in depth, I mean, it's not without problems, obviously, but he considers seriously and in depth, questions of female sexuality, questions of kind of gender positionality, and all the way through, starting from, the three essays on the theory of sexuality, he talks about sexuality's inherent kind of contingency and queerness, and does away with the idea of what normal is, I would say. So I think that as a queer theory book, this side of Freud, the queer side of Freud, is something that was important to me. And I think that the case study of the Wolfman is particularly, indicative of the kind of Freud's inherent queerness, because it's an exploration of a supposedly heterosexual man and the non-heterosexual foundations of his desire and his sexuality. The homoeroticism of this case study, and the idea that sexuality or gender positionality are extremely fluid, all of it is in there. And if you read something like A Child is Being Beaten, to the positioning of the beating adult and the beaten child, and the gendering of this positioning is also extremely fluid. And so I think that his way of describing gender roles is very forward thinking.
I think that's quite an interesting moment you've picked up on, the idea of kind of deploying a queer Freud to read this different range of texts. And I'm interested in how you selected the texts, the kind of the process of choosing the authors. For example, Trollope takes up a whole chapter in the text, and obviously you've mentioned Hollinghurst, but Forster, Henry James, as well, and then why the particular texts by these authors as well?
Well, my favorites. Okay, that's not a good answer, right?
So, no, that's fine.
So I just, I chose the writers that I liked, and of course, that's not a terribly theoretical answer. I know that much, but I think that. Well, and also don't forget J.R. Ackerley, who is not at all known in the United States, very well known in Great Britain. So I chose texts that really play with queer father-son relationship in all kinds of interesting ways, and they offer kind of a paradigm for each chapter, like the father-son marriage plot in Trollope, or the queer counselor man in the James Butler, and then the gay daddy in the Hollinghurst Forster chapter, and then the trans model of fatherhood in the conclusion. So they, they offer particularly interesting paradigms for the explorations of queer patriarchy. And also I think, their status, the status of this author within these authors within the canon, if you will, is sort of also on the margins in terms of their sexuality, with the exception perhaps of Trollope. I mean, he has his own marginality too. I mean, he's a Victorian novelist. Yeah, and I'm writing about Trollope in the field where most everyone writes about George Eliot or Dickens or the Brontes. So Trollope, like, say, Thackeray, is a fairly sort of marginal Victorian author himself, although his sexuality was by no means marginal or queer. Trollope is, you know, a bit of a developing small field, but there's not much on that. So queer authors and a bit marginalized, a bit on the margins of the canon, like Samuel Butler particularly, or like J.R. Ackerley, about whom virtually no one is writing these days.
The way you use all of these authors is part of that kind of broader queering project, but you use them in different ways and pick up on different things. And I think it might be good to go through the different uses. So maybe if we begin with Trollope, and you choose two texts, Dr. Thorne and the Prime Minister. And I'm interested how you think those kind of broader theoretical themes play out in these two texts. But also maybe we could think in particular terms as well, like the idea of the gentleman and Englishness and nationalism are really important, as well as the kind of broader queer theoretical positions that occupy the beginning of the book.
I mean, I wouldn't say that the Trollope chapter sets the tone for kind of the narrative paradigms that I'm exploring later, but you're right about nationalism and the exploration of national identity and the idea of the home, because I think that what I notice in particular in this long stretch of time between early-ish Trollope and kind of and Hollinghurst's novel is the identification of queer patriarchy with particular narratives of English sort of agrarian, rural English nationalism, and the identification of the positive Oedipus with cosmopolitanism, perhaps, and otherness, which seemed to me a reversal of the usual narrative, where normative masculinity is nationalist and queer masculinity is cosmopolitan or othered. I noticed that paradigm being completely reversed through this entire stretch of about 150 years in the narratives of queer patriarchy. So you have Lopez and Scatcherd as the other in Trollope representing normative masculinity, and then you have the father and son who are English aristocrats representing queer patriarchy, and rural England. And you go all the way through Hollinghurst, and you have kind of a set of queer English patriarchs living in the country and defying, you know, the advance of urban cosmopolitanism from London. Many years in between them, but the idea is still the same, and I found that fascinating.
Although shaped, obviously, by different social contexts.
That's true.
And one of the things that I thought was interesting in your discussion of Hollinghurst was that sense of the potential retreat away from London and the city against the backdrop of the 1980s and the AIDS crisis.
Yes.
Which I found a really fascinating reading, actually, of an author who's become, you know, really kind of canonical for English gay identity. Not to jump around sort of too much in the text, one of the things that you talk about in the more theoretical discussion early on in the book is the kind of the reversal of particular binaries, such as those that are, say, to do with fathers and mothers as being split binary positions. And I wonder, how do these play out in the Trollope texts?
They don't as much. I think that the father-son marriage plot is still built around or still based on fairly clear binaries. I think the breakdown of binaries happens closer to the end, both chronologically and the end of the book. I think that we're starting to look at the binaries collapsing, particularly in Forster's Little Ember, where we have this fantasy of all male reproduction, and all kinds of binaries being collapsed when Imber and, you know, his older and Worm, his older gentleman friend, are entering into this, you know, the strange relationships where one is weak and then the other is strong, and one is maternal and the other is paternal. So that sort of is going back and forth in terms of gender roles and positioning. And that echoes very powerfully for me with Leo Bersani's The Gay Daddy, which is a critique of Freud's The Wolfman, and talks about the collapse of binaries to which Freud is still holding on. And then binaries, of course, continue to collapse, and I think reach that final destruction when it comes to trans characters. So when we're talking about trans fathers or trans patriarchs, which, you know, sounds like an oxymoron already, we cannot talk about either, you know, any kind of gender binaries anymore. So we're starting with fairly traditional, you know, heteronormative texts, and we're moving into that have some potential for queer and patriarchy, and are moving into what I see at least as a complete collapse of whatever gender binaries that were upholding the idea of patriarchy in the first place, or private and public sphere, or father and mother, something like that.
And again, reflecting these, you know, broader social changes where, you know, in Trollope's time, there is the, you know, the kind of the policing of the heterosexual family units and, you know, ideas about respectable behaviour and stuff like this, and how this also changes over time. Although it's still there, actually, in, you know, in different ways in people like Forster and Hollinghurst, which, again, is an interesting line that runs through the text.
Yes, there's still policing, absolutely. And Hollinghurst, certainly. I mean, you know, the domain of the gay daddy is very, very carefully policed. Probably not in the way we would expect, but when it comes to kind of weeding out otherness or cosmopolitanism, there's a lot of heavy policing going on.
One of the things that I guess you identify as the, if not the beginning of this queering, but the part of the process of that comes in the third chapter's discussion of Samuel Butler, Henry James, and then Ackley's work. And this is where the idea of the negative Oedipus, I think, is really important. And I wonder if you could tell me a bit about how you read those three authors through this idea.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, we probably all have personal favorites, you know, in our books in terms of the idea. And I think that you know, this chapter in particular probably, you know, is my most important contribution of the idea of the queer consular roman. So I look at the narrative of the artist, right, the consular roman, as fundamentally a traditionally masculine, kind of heteronormative narrative, which is also overlapping with the positive Oedipus of a man moving away from first and then identifying with as his father, in order to pursue that artistic vocation. And so, you know, D.H. Lawrence and Joyce are the modernist writers who come to mind and on whom I sort of base that idea of the heteronormative consular roman of the port of an artist, right? So what I see in Butler and James and in Ackerley is, and, you know, roughly, I know that a lot of people will contest that kind of chronological positioning, but I will roughly characterize all of them as modernist writers. You know, modernism is notoriously difficult to define or kind of, you know, fence in chronologically. And I'm taking advantage of that, and I'm defining all of them as modernists. So what they come up with is the queer consular roman, which overlaps with the negative Oedipal paradigm, where in order to pursue an artistic vocation, the male artist, and again, you know, this is the male consular roman, and they kind of make a nod to the existence of female ones, but I don't talk at length about them. So that said, the male artist, in order to pursue his vocation, needs to submit or stay with the father, and that kind of a loving relationship, homosocial and or homoerotic relationship between a queer son and this father figure, not necessarily actually in new, well, Ackerley has a biological father, but that's, but the other two don't. That kind of a loving relationship with the father is the genesis of artistic creativity. So submission instead of separation, love instead of competition. So this is what the queer consular roman does in the final analysis. Sort of an anti-masculinist version of an artist's progress.
And the inversion of that, Oedipal competitive or murderous sort of narrative.
Yes, inversion's a very good word to use, definitely.
One of the things that comes through, and again, we touched on this a little bit, beyond just the kind of social changes in gender and family units and sexuality, are the material cultures that form the backdrop to all of these authors. And maybe that's something we might think about when considering Chapter 4's discussion of Forster and Hollinghurst, where the materiality of the house, particularly the kitchen, becomes really important to the overall argument of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. Material culture research was really an addition to it. It wasn't anywhere in the dissertation. So I did some archival work and I did some print culture research, overly ambitiously perhaps, trying to connect this kind of queer Freudian approach to material culture. And I guess in some respects it worked out okay. So the title of the chapter on Hollinghurst is The Father's Place is in the Kitchen, Dear, which is obviously just camp on the part of the novel. But I think it also tells us something important about the kind of gender binary collapse that is going on. The gay daddy feels comfortable in the kitchen. So the idea of the gay daddy absorbs comfortably the idea of femininity hitherto on the margins, hitherto, abject. And the novel itself is preoccupied with architecture, the architecture of the South of England in particular, and the main character, the gay daddy, is an architect, and there's a lot of talk about, various houses and a lot of descriptions of various houses. So I wanted to see how, in particular, the house is organized around gender roles. And it used to be that certain rules in the 19th century English house were very heavily kind of redistributed, along the lines of gender roles, particularly the kitchen. And so Hollinghurst takes his gay daddy and places him consistently, in the kitchen all the time. His lover says, he feeds me and he feeds me and he feeds me and he cooks. So part of that comfort with subsuming absorption on the traditionally feminine role or position in the kitchen, that's part of the definition of queer patriarchy. So, yes, I guess I just reinscribed the binary, but I was really honestly trying to destroy it.
And that kind of act of, destruction through an attempt, I guess, to avoid the reinscription is where the book ends. And, we've touched on the discussion of trans fathers and trans fatherhood already, but the other thing to bring up about that code is the book is the inclusion or the move towards contemporary media texts. Mm-hmm. In comparison to the kind of the literary focus earlier in the book, and I'm interested in sort of what the motivation was there. Is that something that you're going to kind of move on in future work, or was it to do with contrasting media texts with literary texts, or was it just because they were quite interesting stories? So you talk about the L word and stuff like that.
Well, I think that it's to throw into relief to emphasize the relevance of this kind of a project to today, which is why I started using pop culture in an attempt to sort of say, oh, look, Trollope did this, but it's still going on and the concerns are the same. And that's something that everybody's watching on TV. So as you do, think about it. Think about how masculinity is changing and evolving and transitioning. And it's not something I'm pursuing in my current project at all, but I thought that drawing, and I have some, some pop culture also in the Forster Hollinghurst chapter, so, drawing this connection between, say, Forster's fantasy of all-male fatherhood all the way through to this little documentary on the Logo Channel, which is a contemporary, LGBT-themed channel in the United States, is to say, well, look, this has been going on for some time and it's still relevant now, and I think as we move on, it's becoming more and more relevant. So just connecting the past and the future, I would say, in a productive way. And I think when people, you know, people respond well to pop culture, and that might be a good way to demonstrate the applicability of those ideas to today.
I mean, it always seems a bit sort of unfair to ask an author when they've just finished a major project and produced a book, what else they're working on or what's next. But is there something completely different you're working on, or are you trying to tease out more of the themes from the book? Is there a kind of another stage in the kind of the process of querying patriarchy, or are you onto something just completely different?
Well, I have side projects in masculinity studies, but my current project is actually not, interestingly enough, not heavily involved with gender studies, not particularly sharply focused on gender studies. I'm working on a project exploring the relationship between fantasy literature, Anglo-American fantasy literature, to Lacanian ethics of psychoanalysis. So I'm exploring the artistic side of it, kind of the relationship between modernism and realism, and also trying to look at some social relevance of this relationship. So, for instance, Lacanian service of the goods and Oscar Wilde's ideas on charity. So the ways in which fantasy writers, particularly Wilde, anticipate some of the Seminar 7 ideas is what's been preoccupying me ever since I finished, that other one.
And are you conceiving of this as a new book or a series of papers? Or?
Well, I have a couple of papers done, and I'm hoping that eventually they will collapse into a book.
Great. I look forward to reading.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien, and I was talking to Helena Gerfinkel, Associate Professor of English at Southern Illinois University, about her new book, Outlaw Fathers in Victorian and Modern British Literature, Queering Patriarchy.